May it please the court. My name is Mark Evans, number 40156. I'm a public defender, and I'm here today representing Mr. Vern Pfeffs. The state has labeled my client a sexually violent predator, and my goal this afternoon is to reiterate to the court that that label is incorrect for two completely independent reasons, both of which, standing alone, require reversal of that designation. Now, one of those reasons is almost purely legal in nature. It's best expressed in People v. Gallegos, and I'll plan to return to that reason later in the argument. The other one is more fact-intensive. And the heart of that reason for reversal is that, regardless of what meaning this court assigns to the phrase established a relationship, the supposed factual findings relied upon to designate my client an SVP simply are not supported by the record. And it's those findings, made by an evaluator, not by a court, that I'd like to start by talking about. I want to start there not because I think that the Gallegos argument is weak. To the contrary, I think that it controls here and requires reversal. But I want to start by talking about the factual findings because it's those grounds for reversal that make it most clear that no remand is required here, and this court can simply vacate the SVP finding and end this case. It's the nature of the SVP assessment screening instrument that if a certain number of boxes are checked, then the client is for the rest of his or her life branded a sexually violent predator. And by statute, four prongs must be satisfied in order to establish that somebody is an SVP. In this case, a minimum of five boxes had to be checked in order to establish the relationship prong and the risk of reoffending prong of that assessment. And it was just five boxes, the minimum required, that were checked on Mr. Faust's assessment. On appeal, we contend that three of those were wrong, two pertaining to the purpose for which the relationship existed, and one of those boxes pertaining to whether he's at high risk to reoffend. And it's that one box on the sex offender risk scale at the very end of the assessment that can most cleanly end this case. The assessment indicates, by way of a single check mark, that Mr. Faust was employed less than full-time when he was arrested, but that simply is not the case. At sentencing, before the court made its SVP finding, Mr. Faust told the court that he was employed full-time and that he was in the process of obtaining verification of that fact. He did obtain that verification in the form of both an affidavit from an officer of the court and a letter from the same immediate prior employer listed in the PSI stating that he was employed full-time or over 35 hours a week as of the date that he was arrested. And in the court's second ruling, made after that letter was received, it acknowledged that a mistake had been made. The court found that it is the overall findings of the evaluator that the court relies upon, even if there are errors in one of the tests used to evaluate risk. But that's not right. If there was a mistake made in checking that box, then Mr. Faust does not meet the risk to reoffend prong of the SVP assessment.
Mr. Evans, other than noting that even if a mistake had been made, did the court make any specific findings as to the employment status?
No, Your Honor, except that the court did note that the only thing that its second order was really about was that employment status. And then it acknowledges that closer to the beginning of the order, and then on that very last page where it makes a ruling, that's where it says, even if a mistake was made, then we're going to go with the evaluator's ruling.
So you're arguing that the introduction to the order and then that somewhat vague sentence read together would implicate a finding on the employment status?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe it does. Even if it doesn't, I mean, my position is that it does and that the court acknowledged that that a mistake was made. Even if it doesn't amount to a finding, the district court still had an obligation under statute to make a finding, especially on a contested issue of fact.
So if the court had an obligation to make a finding and then did not, in fact, make one, wouldn't it be appropriate to remand for such a finding to be made?
But, Your Honor, the same evidence that was before the district court is before this court now. All the district court had to operate off of was the PSI and that letter presented by Mr. Faust. And presumably the court could have incorporated the DOC diagnostic summary that was received shortly before that order was issued. And those are all, the content of those documents is not disputed here. It's just the interpretation and the sufficiency of the content of those documents that's disputed.
Counsel, except for judicial economy, why wouldn't we remand it to the district court to make that determination if it didn't make it the first time?
Your Honor, I think that the interests of judicial economy are best served by avoiding having the remand the possibility of another finding, another appeal, and then potentially another remand.
Any other reasons besides that, then, the judicial economy reason that we shouldn't remand it?
Yes, Your Honor. As expressed in People v. Tufo, the burden was on the state here to prove that the prongs of the SVP assessment were made. And it's uncontested that the state was trying to prove that that last prong, the risk to reoffend prong, was met. It gathered the evidence that it wanted to gather, it presented that to the district court, and now it's before this, that same evidence is before this court on appeal. And you just don't get to a preponderance of the evidence when weighing the PSI against the letter provided by Mr. Faust's employer.
Mr. Evans, let me follow up on my colleague's questions. And as you know, there have been some cases where divisions of our court have remanded for an SVP determination. And in the Gallegos case, the division did not remand, and that was in part because the people did not argue that there was an alternative basis for finding of SVP. But as I understand it here, your argument is that at least in part, that the trial court did not make a specific finding as to whether or not Mr. Faust was employed on the date of his arrest. Is that correct?
That is correct, but in most of the cases where we see a remand back to the trial court, the question that it's being remanded to answer goes to the relationship prong of the SVP finding. That, you know, if an established finding was incorrect, then we'll remand it so you can look at promoted, or vice versa. It's not here. That risk to reoffend prong is a separate finding, one of the four findings that has to be made in order to establish that someone is an SVP, and there's no either or with that prong. I mean, everybody was focused on proving that prong, which is, you know, it's the part three of the SVP instrument.
Well, as I understand your argument, you're basically saying that the record speaks for itself, and that there's, since we would not be remanding for the obtaining of additional evidence, we're in as good a position as the district court to look at the record and determine whether or not Mr. Faust was employed on the date of his arrest. Is that?
That's correct, Your Honor. And additionally, there's, regardless of whether there's a legal basis for it or not, there's a certain logical absurdity to remanding the case just so the district court can determine whether or not some indicator existed, which has since been shown to not even be indicative.
Well, you say since been shown, but that means by submitting letters. However, there's some indication in the PSI to begin with, depending on how you read the language, that he wasn't employed. So shouldn't the court have to resolve credibility choices between the letters and the information in the PSI? I mean, you're asking us to accept that the letters were deemed credible, and I don't think that the court really made a finding as to whether he accepted the letters or not.
The court did not make a credibility finding as to the letters, but the prosecutor never contested that they were inaccurate. And in fact, the prosecutor never responded to our motion when we submitted the letters to the court.
But they didn't concede that they were accurate, did they?
No, the prosecution did not concede that they're accurate. Okay.
So isn't there a difference between not conceding and not contesting? I mean, you see what I mean? If the court didn't make a finding, you're saying that that there's only one finding that could be made simply because the prosecution didn't contest, but they also didn't concede.
But it was the prosecution's burden to do one or the other. If the prosecutor wanted to, it was the prosecutor's burden to prove that Mr. Faust met the prongs of the assessment. And once this information is presented to the court, that if it's accurate, definitively answers the question as to whether or not that box was wrongfully checked, I think that not responding to that is as good as a concession. But Judge Rose, I do want to rewind just a second and clarify that when I said no longer even indicative, I wasn't just referring to the letter itself. It's that the whole concept of whether or not someone is employed at the time of arrest is no longer considered indicative by SOMB of whether or not somebody is going to reoffend, which in my mind creates a certain absurdity to remanding just to look at that prong.
Except that I know it may seem anomalous, but I thought you agreed in your briefs that under the applicable 2008 handbook that this, whether someone was employed, is an appropriate criterion.
No, that is correct. I mean, I do agree to that. And again, as I did a poor job of expressing, that's not necessarily a legal argument. It's a common sense one.
Counsel, I'd like to hear your Gallegos argument that you referred to earlier.
The full extent of the Gallegos argument is that I cannot for the life of me think of how you can meaningfully distinguish Gallegos from this case. And, you know, Gallegos stands for the common sense proposition that if you already have an established relationship, you can't establish a relationship for the purpose of victimization. And the evidence is absolutely undisputed in this case that my client was married to the victim's mother for 8 years before this case arose. And the PSI indicates that there was an established parental relationship there. So the Gallegos argument, I wanted to bring to this court's attention to see if the court had questions about the application of that case to this situation.
Your response to the argument that the term established has a technical meaning as argued by the people?
That the four questions that appear in that portion of the SVP assessment relating to whether or not a relationship was established, just as Gallegos expresses, those have to deal with whether the primary purpose of the relationship was victimization. To the extent that the Attorney General argues that SOMB can define the word established as absolutely anything that it wants to define it as, I think that that is an absurd delegation of power on behalf of the General Assembly and is completely contrary to any reading of the statute.
Mr. Evans, since we've been talking a lot about remand, let me ask you with regard to the Gallegos issue, if we were to agree with your argument, do you agree that we should remand the case for a determination under promoted a relationship rather than established a relationship?
No, because if this court agrees with the high-risk portion, the employment finding, if this court agrees that that finding is not supported by the evidence, then regardless of the established or promoted option, the SVP criteria are not met. So no remand is necessary for that reason. But even if this court, and I would direct this court to People v. Valencia, which clearly points out that the promoted prong, there has to be something else there other than just the sexual assault itself. The relationship has to be expanded in some way, and here the record is completely absent of any information indicating that that was the case. I would like to save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Very well, Mr.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Your Honors. My name is Rhonda White. My attorney registration number is 35996, and I represent the people in this matter. I would like to, of course, address the defendant's sexually violent predator or SVP designation, but I just want to reiterate the criteria under the SVP statute. In essence, an offender must meet four specific and separate criteria, that being one, that they're over the age of 18 or at the age of 18 or older when the offense is committed, two, that they have been convicted of one of the enumerated offenses, three, that they meet the specific relationship criteria, and fourth, that they are determined to be likely to reoffend by committing one of the enumerated offenses under the specific relationship criteria. I think just for some background, the legislature has clearly recognized the necessity of providing for comprehensive identification and evaluation of sex offenders. And I think that they've created a program to standardize such treatment. I think the legislature has clearly dictated to the Sex Offender Management Board to develop these criteria to make these determinations. And as part of these responsibilities, the Sex Offender Management Board has created the legislative directed risk assessment that contains all four of those required criteria. I think I'll start with part four, the likelihood to reoffend. And I think it's clear in this case that the defendant refused to participate in the evaluation. So both the evaluator and the probation officer were directed to use a modified risk scale. Typically, the risk scale at the very end of the evaluation would be 10 factors. Here, because of the defendant's refusal, there were only 6 factors that were used. One of those, obviously the one at issue here, is whether or not this defendant was employed full-time at the time of his arrest. And I think the fact that he subsequently brought in information or potential affidavits or letters to change the evaluator's determination simply because clearly he was unhappy with these results really flies in the face of what the evaluation is trying to do. I think that provides no incentive for a defendant to participate. It really doesn't give any finality to this designation if we're allowing defendants to come back later on to provide information that he clearly could have provided at the time of this evaluation. However, I do think that the pre-sentence report clearly indicates that he had sporadic work patterns, that he would go through periods of unemployment. And so I think that that factual determination that was made was clearly supported by the record. And I think the trial court properly refused to reopen this designation based on subsequent information.
And Ms. White, the PSI does say that he was most recently employed at Gardner Farms, I think it was, but it didn't specify when the employment ended. And so you're saying that that was evidence that he was unemployed when they just say he was most recently employed at a certain place?
He was. It specifically says he was employed as a farmhand from 2007 to 2008. And again, it doesn't say the specific date that the work ended, but he didn't give that information to the evaluator at the time. He was specifically advised that if he did not participate in this evaluation, this modified risk assessment, the sex offender risk scale, would be used. And I think the fact that we have information that does indicate sporadic work patterns and potential unemployment periods really does support the information that the evaluator or the probation officer had. And the trial court, I think, did not want to go back into this because we could have defendants come back repeatedly to show information that might change. And again, we don't know the credibility of this information.
So are you saying that if he doesn't participate, they can say, well, we aren't sure whether he was employed or not, but he didn't answer, so we can just assume that he was unemployed based on a sporadic past work history?
I don't think that that's necessarily true, but I think the evaluation clearly shows that they used his self-reporting and the police report to make that determination. And I think the trial court decided, I'm not going to reopen this when you're unhappy with the results, to come back and now give new information that you easily could have provided at the time. And I think, you know, while we do have information, the record is not void of any indication that there were sporadic work patterns. So I think, you know, the trial court reviewed that and came back and said, I'm not going to redo this entire determination.
I have two related questions on this issue. One, is your position that a defendant is precluded from or may not present additional information to the court via an affidavit, as Mr. Faust did here?
I think subsequent to the determination, yes. I think once that determination is made, because this isn't an issue that would have been problematic for him. This was an employment history. It had no negative connotations to it. It was simply providing this information at the time. And he could have either reported this information. I mean, there's no indication that he stated to the probation officer or the evaluator because he refused to participate. But they did rely on prior self-reporting of his sporadic work patterns. And so I think, you know, while we have the information in the pre-sentence report, the evaluator has all of this information from the self-report, the police report, and I think they're really in the best position to make this determination, and the trial court agreed with that.
Okay. Here's my second question. Did the trial court make a specific finding as to whether or not Mr. Faust was employed?
I think We have several cases that state that by adopting these evaluations, it shows that the trial court has looked at the information and agrees with the evaluation. And I think by simply, they did a pretty thorough order going through each of the requirements to make the sexual violent predator determination. And so, yes, I think that the court did make at least adequate findings to make this determination valid.
You say at least adequate findings. Is that the same thing as making specific findings? And isn't that what the court's required to do?
I think that they are. I think that they did. They went through each of the categories and decided that each of those four initial factors were met. And I think there's case law under, I believe it's People versus Bruges and People versus Brosh that are cited in the briefs, that that is enough to implicitly adopt those findings. But here we have a court going through each of the factors. And so I think that is specific enough.
Before we get too far in your time, I'd like to go to the argument that the SOMB can interpret the statutory establish or promote criteria basically any way it likes. Is that your position or is that a misstatement of it?
I don't think that it's any way that it likes. I think it's based on research, training, and experience. And I think if we look at the standardized treatment statute and the sexual violent predator statute, it clearly allows for this to be defined.
That seems fine and dandy when they're interpreting it broadly, but what if they interpreted it narrowly? For example, based on training and experience, they said that the defendant has to provide gifts to a child or it doesn't qualify as establish or promote. What would your response be in that situation?
Well, I'm not sure that it's limited to simply gifts to a child. I think...
Well, what if they said it was in their professional experience?
I think that, you know, that would be their professional experience. I doubt that it would be limited to that point. However, I believe that they have the experience. We have a huge board of experienced, trained mental health professionals that are working together to develop these. So I certainly don't think that it would necessarily limit this. I think they're trying to get it right. I think they're trying to make the accurate assessment. And if we have something that is, ridiculous, such as providing a gift or something to that effect, we obviously do have the trial court's discretion to reject that.
So you're saying that there is some level of review as far as their ability to interpret the statutory criteria.
I believe so, but I think that we need to give them deference because they've been legislatively directed to develop this evaluation. And so for us to come in, and it's the people's position that it is a technical definition for both the established and promoted, a relationship criteria, and to use a dictionary definition, I think really goes against what they're trying to get at. For example, in People versus Gallegos, it was determined that if there is an existing relationship, then this we would not fall under the established a relationship criteria. However, I think the whole point of the criteria is to get at what is this offender's purpose. We can't go back 8 years and determine what this defendant's intention was when he entered into the relationship with his now wife, with the child. I think to limit that to simply having a definable relationship really goes against what the experienced, trained evaluators are saying. No, if you meet two of these factors, this means you've done this for this particular purpose.
You had a fallback argument that if we stuck with the Gallegos interpretation of established, that the court could still make findings. The evidence was there to support promote. What would that evidence be?
I believe the appropriate thing would be I think you could affirm on those grounds. However, if you look at, similar to the established a relationship, under the promoted prong, there are factors that you would look at. The first one is, basically taking steps to facilitate this assault. And I think that happened here. I think if we're looking at what happened, this person waited until his wife was asleep and presumably the child was asleep. And he effectively closed a door that was normally open in order for, his wife to hear her child. I think taking steps to do that, and again, the record here is limited because we have a guilty plea. So I think, there's certainly that indication. And I also think that, there was an isolation of this child by, putting her in this room, by closing the door. I think that there are factors that are met under the promoted, the relationship criteria. And the reason that I would suggest, I think our position first would be to hold off on a ruling until Gallegos an opinion has been issued for the Supreme Court. I think this is not a determinative factor, but I think these are very closely related cases. I think that would be extremely helpful to have guidance on this issue. But I think because the evaluation separates these three relationships and it makes it essentially mutually exclusive, if you find stranger, you don't continue on to review, establish a relationship, or promoted a relationship. I think because here the evaluator found established, they did not consider, they were directed not to consider the promoted a relationship criteria. And so now that we have further definitions from, you know, this court, I think that to go back and then say, okay, if we're not under established a relationship, we need to determine, I think that you could affirm on the fact that this was promoted, but I think that you would need to remand for determination on that issue.
Ms. White, let me follow up on that last comment of yours with regard to the question of remanding for a determination of that issue. On the one hand, some people might say that, as you're suggesting, that remand is would be the appropriate course of action, so the trial court would have an opportunity to consider those factors. On the other hand, some people would argue that the people shouldn't have two bites at the apple in order to get it right. So why would you argue in favor, or why are you arguing in favor of remand as opposed to saying the people only have one shot at it?
Well, I think that it's, you know, basically comparing, you know, they thought that they had a bite at one apple, but the apple changed. So, I think that it's appropriate now that something has been defined further. And I think, you know, that's what we've learned from Gallegos, is that if it's not under established, it potentially might be under promoted. And I don't think it's two, you know, bites of the same apple. I think it would be a structured remand to address simply that issue, because we now have information. And this is only if we're sticking with the analysis from Gallegos. I think that, you know, if that's the case, then it would be appropriate to do that.
Could you clarify the timeline for me? Because I'm not sure. But I know Gallegos was decided
in September.
In 2009. Was that before or after the trial court decided here?
The trial court, I know the evaluation was completed in April 2009, and I don't have the specific date. I'm assuming it was fairly soon after that. I think it was 2009. Gallegos came out in September of 2009, I believe, and this evaluation was completed in April of 2009. So I think, you know, that would be an appropriate remedy. I believe that, you know, there is some discrepancy on the factors that were met here under established. I think that there are two factors that are clearly met. Clearly, this victim was not able to, to consent because she was 8 years old. So I think if we're outside of the realm of established, we would need to remand for promoted. But again, I would encourage the court to hold off on any decision until the Gallegos case has been fully concluded.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. White.
Thank you.
A couple things I'd like to address from the Attorney General's argument. First of all, the Attorney General said that we should read the established relationship criteria as if two or more of the boxes are checked, then it was for this purpose. And I could not agree more. I think that the four boxes go toward the purpose of the relationship. But remember, it's kind of a two-part finding. The relationship has to be established for the primary purpose of victimization. Those four boxes all go to the purpose of the relationship. They say nothing about whether it was established for that purpose. And there's just no indication, either in the statute or even in the SVP assessment instrument handbook, that we should completely divorce the word established from its commonly understood meaning. Second, going back to the promoted a relationship criteria, the Attorney General said something to the effect of, it's unfair to, you were using the phrase getting a second bite at the apple, and the Attorney General said that the apple changed. But it didn't here. It is not, the evaluator did not skip the promoted section. Maybe he was supposed to, but the fact of the matter is, no was indicated twice as the evaluator was going through. And at sentencing, we argued that that didn't apply. We stood up and said, before the court made its determination, that that shouldn't, that that prong was not met.
Didn't the form have one no box and one in a box, though? Further down, subsequently, it had a not applicable box. Yeah, we can look at it. That's, I don't want to use up all your rebuttal time on it.
Okay. But let me ask you about a different apple then. Let me ask you about a different apple.
Okay.
And to go to what your counterpart, Ms. White, suggested, is there any prejudice to your client in us holding off until the Gallegos decision is reached by the Supreme Court?
No. There's not. I don't think this court has to, and that's why I started emphasizing the employment finding, because there are three erroneous factual determinations here that require reversal, even had Gallegos never been decided, even if we weren't looking at that part at all. So this court certainly doesn't have to, but I see my time is up. Would you like
to finish your statement?
I don't know that it would. My client has a lengthy sentence. I don't know that waiting for Gallegos is going to change his life one way or another.
Thank you very much, Evans. Thank you again, Ms. White. We appreciate your very good arguments in this case. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. So.